60 state lawmakers, Democrats and Republicans, calling on the governor to explain a lack of transparency concerning apparent hotspots statewide. The story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. The letter to Governor Abbott cites coronavirus outbreaks at long-term care facilities for the elderly and the lack of information on what's being done to protect residents and staffers. Also, a federal class action lawsuit that claims thousands are being denied relief checks because they're married to immigrants without social security numbers. Also, Dr. Fred Campbell of UT Health San Antonio takes on more listener questions about COVID-19 and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 30th day of April 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Hope your Thursday's been going well so far. Tomorrow is not going to be your usual Friday, that's for sure. Lots of folks looking forward to the beginning of a return to a new normal in Texas as the state begins to relax rules and stores, restaurants, and state beaches begin to reopen. Other Texans fearing that this could be the start of a downward spiral as the state has not yet hit what many healthcare officials believe is a prerequisite for lifting stay-at-home orders, namely 14 consecutive days of declining numbers in coronavirus cases. Yesterday at this time, we told you about concerns that some of Texas's smaller cities, including Amarillo and Abilene, are becoming the state's new coronavirus hotspots. But there's a separate concern that the state is not being straightforward with Texans about more localized outbreaks happening in residential centers that care for some of Texas's vulnerable populations. More than 60 Democratic and Republican lawmakers have now added their signatures to a letter to Governor Greg Abbott demanding more transparency and protections for residents and staff in long-term senior care facilities statewide. The author of that letter joins us now. He is Democratic State Representative James Tallarico of Round Rock. Representative, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about why you thought it was important to write this letter to the governor. Something happening in your district?
Yeah, so nationwide, the numbers I'm seeing show that somewhere between a quarter and half of all COVID-related deaths are occurring in long-term care facilities. And that is true right here in our community. So I represent Southeast Williamson County. And over the weekend, we had 50 patients in a Round Rock nursing home test positive for COVID-19. So these facilities, folks are clustered together in tight spaces, and they're also some of our most vulnerable. So they're the elderly, they're our disabled Texans, and they need our protection more than any other population.
Specifically, what is it that you're asking the governor to do at this juncture?
Yeah, so we're asking him to surge resources to where they're needed most to protect our elderly Texans and Texans with disabilities in these long-term care facilities. So first, we're asking for emergency funding for hazard pay and personal protective equipment for the frontline workers in these centers. Second, we're asking for more transparent reporting so that we're breaking out the numbers statewide of how many of these cases and how many of these deaths have occurred in long-term care facilities like nursing homes, group homes, and state-supported living centers. And then lastly, we want universal mandatory testing at every one of these facilities. Tragically, we have a shortage of testing in this country and in this state. That's a scandal that we will investigate after this emergency has passed. But since we do have a limited capacity, we want to make sure that we are surging that capacity to where it can do the most good, which is in these facilities around the state.
Representative, I want to understand a little bit more about this lack of transparency. What information is the state, is it hiding information? I guess I should ask you that, because this lack of transparency is puzzling to a lot of people, given the stakes here.
Yeah, and a lot of other states have found ways to report out these numbers so we know where the outbreaks are occurring while still appreciating and protecting patient privacy. You know, we want to strike a balance, but right now, Texas is not striking that balance, and it's very difficult to overcome a pandemic when you don't have up-to-date, accurate data. And so the first thing we need to do if we're going to overcome this pandemic is ensuring we know where outbreaks are occurring so that we can send resources there and prevent these situations from becoming tragedies. And that is true in Williamson County, and it's true in communities across Texas.
When he announced his plans to further reopen the economy this week, Governor Abbott also announced new nursing home protection protocols. Is that not enough to satisfy you and your colleagues?
It's not nearly enough. It's sadly too little too late. And the governor feels a lot of urgency around reopening small businesses. And I do too. I want our small businesses to get back up on their feet. I want people to be able to make a living. I wish the governor felt the same urgency about protecting these vulnerable populations. I wish he cared as much about protecting nursing homes as he does about reopening movie theaters. Sadly, we have not done our due diligence, and I hope that changes with this letter. It came from a wide array of legislators in the Texas House. Far-right Republicans and far-left Democrats signed on to this letter, and so I hope this is a clear message to the governor that we can and must do more for elderly Texans and Texans with disabilities.
It's my understanding we've reached out to the governor's office. We have not heard back yet. Have you heard anything from the governor after sending him this letter?
I have not, but I have been coordinating with our Health and Human Services agency since the beginning to make sure we had accurate information for this letter. And after we submitted the letter to the governor, we called to check in, and they said that the emergency Medicaid rate increase had been approved, which means that the first bullet point of emergency funding looks like it will be headed to our long-term care facilities around the state.
That's Democratic State Representative James Tallarico. We'll have a copy of the letter we're talking about over at texasstandard.org. Representative Tallarico, thanks again.
Thank you.
Time now to turn to your questions about COVID-19. We've been doing this for a while, asking listeners to drop us a line about anything they want to know about the coronavirus, and we're doing our best to get answers once a week from Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Glad to be here again, Dave.
Always good to have you. Let's jump right into the questions. This first one comes from F.J. Zider. FJ writes, how can we know if there are COVID-19 cases in our neighborhood? I don't think that this listener is asking for names or addresses or anything, but just whether there are cases very close to home. I mean, is there a tool out there that you're aware of, Dr. Campbell?
Well, it's easy to be apprehensive about the presence of COVID-19 in the community, and certainly in large urban areas, there is a high incidence of asymptomatic positive COVID-19, the likelihood of being able to differentiate who's positive and who isn't is going to be highly, highly difficult. And so I would say you have to treat everyone as if they are potentially infectious.
Now, this is a question that some members of the Texas Standard staff wanted to know. We know that we should be wearing face masks in public. What about gloves? Does wearing gloves offer any meaningful protection from the virus for yourself and others, or not so much?
Gloves are used in intensive care and other settings where patients who are definitely being treated for COVID-19 are taken care of by health professionals. Outside of that, in the community, gloves probably give a false sense of security, and there is nothing better, really, than, of course, doing those avoidance and the physical separation techniques, and then, of course, frequent hand washing, particularly when one is out in the community.
Using soap and water. You don't have to count on the alcohol or anything like that, just soap and water.
Soap and water is as good as any other technique.
This next question comes to us from an anonymous listener. Does putting items in the freezer kill the virus? Is this an alternative to disinfecting packaged items?
To my knowledge, there have not been a lot of studies about how much and how long freezing needs to be done to kill the virus. I think theoretically that's probably going to happen, but it would be much more practical to use a disinfecting solution. Or dilute Clorox solutions to clean packages. And so I don't think freezing is necessarily the optimum technique.
One other thing, I think that this is particularly important as we think about the gradual reopening of the Lone Star State under the governor's incremental plan. how should we be thinking about the reopening of Texas?
Reliance on our public health experts, I think, is uppermost in a situation like this. It is a very, very anxiety-provoking situation to try to reopen the economy. Rule of thumb recently has been that the incidence of cases must start decreasing for at least a two-week period before we would consider increasing the amount of physical continuity in the community.
But given that, though, there are a lot of employers who are going to be bringing their employees back to work, and they won't have the option of collecting unemployment insurance, is my understanding, after that point. So I'm just sort of wondering, how should we as Texans be thinking about that gradual phased in return? Should we decide it's okay, we can go back to work, or not so much?
I can't speak for any one individual, but as someone who respects the opinion of experts in controlling what has been a very, very dangerous kind of situation, that it would be important to follow the recommendations of experts in waiting at least a two-week period of time with decreasing cases before we would consider the situation in the community to be safe.
Dr. Fred Campbell is a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School of Medicine at UT Health San Antonio. We have him on regularly over the course of the coronavirus pandemic to answer your questions. Now, if you have something that you'd like to ask, you know where to find us on Twitter, Facebook. Just go to texasstandard.org/coronavirus, and you'll find a form there to submit your questions to Dr. Fred Campbell. Thanks so much for joining us again. We certainly do appreciate your clarity.
Thank you.
All right, social media editor Wells Dunbar joins us again with the Talk of Texas. What are you hearing, Wells?
Hey, David. Well, 3.8 million Americans filed for unemployment last week, bringing the total to a jaw-dropping 30 million over 6 weeks of the coronavirus pandemic. Some 254,000 Texans filed last week alone. On our Facebook page, Deborah Russell says she was still displaced from Hurricane Harvey after it took a direct hit on Copano Bay in rural Aransas County when the pandemic struck. An educational contractor with schools that's out of work, she says she filed for unemployment. Still nothing and no stimulus check yet, since I have to wait for that paper check in the mail. And Janice Hitchcock says this about the folks on the unemployment rolls. You were just alluding to this, David. And now if those people's bosses decide to open up, they'll be cut off of unemployment unless they can prove they have a virus that they can't get tested for. Just one of the stories we're watching. Appears Texas A&M, Texas Tech plan to be resuming classes in the fall. Hearing a lot about that. I'll be back with that and more later in the show.
Yeah, also federal guidelines on social distancing expiring today will not be renewed, according to the president. Let us hear from you, Texas. Look for us at Texas Standard.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, here to help Texas families navigate this crisis with regular updates, resources, and advice. More at texaschildrenscoronavirus.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. It's an issue so big it drew the attention of the New York Times. The double whammy Houston is getting right now, not just from the coronavirus, but from the oil business. Thousands of energy workers in Texas recently laid off or furloughed. Oil is used to booms and busts, but this one's unusually bad. Oil prices have never fallen so low, and demand is expected to remain that way for some time. Houston Public Media's Kyra Buckley wanted to find out how laid-off oil and gas workers are hoping to stay afloat during these uncertain times.
Jeff Lodia wants to stay in the oil and gas industry. So when he was laid off from his job in Houston about a month ago, he had a new one within 24 hours.
The day that I got laid off, within an hour, not only did I have my resume updated and sent out to new companies, but I also had signed up for Instacart, you know, to get my background check going and things like that.
Lodia is a level 3 non-destructive testing welding inspector. He makes sure equipment is safe. He's worked in oil and gas since 2012 and says staying in the industry will mean making sacrifices.
Yeah, you're going to have to be on top of it, and you're going to have to look for things outside of your comfort zone that maybe you were okay with doing or that you could pick up on quickly, or even be willing to take a pay reduction.
And that's what Ladia did. He says he's still working as an inspector, but making less than half of what he used to per hour. According to filings with the state, in the past 5 weeks, at least 6,000 energy workers in Texas have been told they're either laid off or furloughed. More than 4,000 of them are in Houston. That's one reason why Ladia says those new to oil and gas should consider something else, or if you can, use this time to up your skills or go back to school. Katie Maynard agrees. She's the CEO of industry group Pink Petro.
So a lot of this is about learning how to get through that hardship, but then setting aside a bank, so to speak, of money and resources so that you can look at reskilling. You can look at options.
Maynard says energy workers are already resilient and highly skilled.
You need to be making sure that you're visible in tough times, because tough times do not last, but tough people, tough brands, tough companies, right, do.
Maynard's company is among those working with University of Houston researchers to gauge how the energy workforce is feeling during the pandemic. So far, they've heard from more than 400 workers. Most thought companies were responding well, but more than half of those workers are still worried about the future of their jobs. Christiane Spitzmuller is one of the UH professors working on the study. She says oil and gas workers may need to find work in other industries, but that they are well equipped to do so.
And there's a lot of things in energy that are pretty cool and unique skill sets, you know, navigating with a lot of flexibility, being culturally aware of interacting with people from a lot of different cultures, technical skill sets, you know, that are highly sought after.
Spitzmuller also says to think creatively about who you network with for new opportunities.
Who are people you've worked with professionally outside the industry? Who are people who you have as acquaintances who you can rely on for networking? And how can you leverage some of your networks to progress this next step of your career?
Welding inspector Jeff Ladia says those networks are key. He says even if you're upset about getting laid off, don't post about it on social media or badmouth your old employer.
You know, this is a time to build connections and do whatever you can do to make money.
He says if you want to rejoin the industry if it does recover, be willing to do something in the short term to make ends meet, invest in training, and don't post anything online that might hurt your chances of networking in the future. I'm Kyra Buckley in Houston.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Who among us couldn't use some extra money, especially as incomes have been cut drastically in the wake of this pandemic? All you need to do is follow a well-known Instagrammer to have a chance at winning, sometimes as much as $5,000. Well, despite what Insta influencers may tell you, these giveaways are not charity. They are a money-making scheme. Fancy that. Tech expert Omar Gallaga is here to help us understand what we probably should know already, that free is seldom free. Hey there, Omar. Good to talk with you, sir.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
There are a lot to unpack here. First of all, what are these Instagram influencers offering their followers and what are they asking for in return? Maybe you can lay this out for us.
Typically, these are people who have a lot of followers on the platform, people who have, you know, who might be in fashion or fitness or in these, you know, very Instagram friendly categories. And, you know, their whole business in life is to draw more followers and to kind of provide a window into their lifestyle. And they are usually very hooked up with sponsors, you know, with people who give them promotional items to give away or you know, free trips. But what we're seeing now is kind of a shift toward just straight cash. That's really what people need right now. And so they are kind of shifting away from giving, you know, handbags and trips to giving just money to followers.
That's pretty interesting, because if you have an influencer offering you money, who's going to say no and why would you exactly? What is it that they're asking for?
Well, these are giveaways, and a lot of them are what are called loop giveaways, where you have to follow a set number of people on Instagram. They kind of give you a list and say, you know, here are the rules to be eligible for this giveaway. And what ends up happening is you might end up having to follow a whole group of people that a marketer or a company wants you to follow. And then, you know, they are getting the information from you to be able to market to you in the future. And the other thing that the influencer gets is they usually will get a boost in followers from from doing giveaways like this. They'll get a bunch of new followers who want to be eligible for that money. So, you know, in the long run, the more followers they have, the more sponsors they're going to have in the future, the more influence they have. So it's kind of a win-win on their side. If you don't win anything, all you've really gotten is just a bunch of new people to follow on your Instagram.
It almost sounds like a modern day version of the old chain letter. You know, if you'll send this to 10 other people, you know, then there'll be a windfall at the end of the day.
That's exactly it. It's about building networks. It's about making these influencers even more popular. And it's about kind of connecting brands with, you know, individual Instagram users who might not otherwise follow, you know, specific brands or specific influencers. It's about kind of building out these networks.
But if all you're doing is, you know, connecting to other influencers on Instagram, is there anything illegal here?
There are definitely some FTC rules on, you know, promotion. Like, these things have to be clearly labeled as, you know, giveaways. They have to have very clear rules on you know, who is eligible and how you're supposed to win. But there are some jurisdictions that want influencers to go further. They want to be able to make sure that they're not targeting kids. They want to make sure that that the right information is being collected. So it really depends on where that influencer is based, on, you know, what the legality is of this. But definitely the FTC seems to be taking a closer look at this. I mean, years ago, I don't know if you remember, but there was a whole crackdown on blogs that were you know, being promoted, but the bloggers were not, you know, disclosing that. So the FTC made a bunch of rules about having to disclose when a piece of content is an ad. It's looking like they may be doing that with Instagram soon too.
So what's your advice to someone who thinks, well, what have I got to lose? I'm just clicking around Instagram. You know, the promise is, you know, thousands of dollars.
You know, I have seen some giveaways that seem pretty legit and are not, you know, loop related. I've seen some celebrities giving out money just saying, you know, hey, I have $1,000 to give away. I'm going to give it to, you know, this random person, you know, or the 10th person that sends me a direct message. Some of those seem like they're okay. But anything that requires you to follow people, that requires you to take some sort of action where your information is being given away, or you're having to connect to a brand or people you don't know, like, that is usually the catch, is your information is being given away.
Omar Gayaga does his influencing over at TechMinuteTexas.com. Omar, good to have you back on the broadcast. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I have no cash to give. Thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, who is helping patients fight cancer with telemedicine. Virtual online appointments are essential in helping patients continue their cancer journey while practicing safe social distancing. Learn more at TexasOncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. More than a quarter of a million Texans filed new unemployment claims last week, according to figures the U.S. Labor Department released today. Fewer people may be eligible for benefits, though, once Governor Greg Abbott's executive order opening certain businesses takes effect Friday. The Texas Workforce Commission is developing guidelines for who still qualifies for unemployment. Agency spokesperson Cisco Gomez says there may be exceptions made for people who choose not to return to work, even if they're offered their job back.
And some of those situations could be related to child care, or they could be related to COVID-19 health issues, or maybe this person is helping take care of someone that has COVID-19. So we're looking into those situations.
Since mid-March, about 1.75 million Texans have applied for unemployment. Child welfare groups in Texas want the state to start focusing on early childhood programs as the coronavirus pandemic continues. As KUT's Ashley Lopez reports, advocates say support for babies and toddlers has long been lacking.
Texas is home to one of every 10 children in the country. But groups say the state does not invest enough in making sure infants, toddlers, and their families can access things like health care and child care. Texas has the highest uninsured rate among children in the country, and its child care sector isn't meeting the needs of many parents. Stephanie Rubin is with Texans Care for Children, which is among the child welfare groups that has launched a project aimed at coming up with policy solutions for these problems as the pandemic continues.
There's no question that health coverage and child care have really risen to the top of the priority list of things that states need to address urgently in order for people to be healthy and, you know, for businesses to reopen.
Rubin says many child care centers will likely not be able to reopen after stay-at-home orders lift. And if employees can't find child care, they will simply not be able to return to work.
Ashley Lopez reporting. Texas A&M University is leading a clinical trial in testing a vaccine developed for tuberculosis to fight COVID-19. Researchers are recruiting 1,800 healthcare workers to take the drug. Dr. Jeffrey Cirillo, who's leading the study, says the vaccine BCG is not likely to prevent COVID-19, but significantly reduce symptoms.
What has been observed is that when this vaccine is given, there's a reduction in death rate as well as severity of disease for a number of different viral infections.
The shots will first be administered next week. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Although we are all feeling the effects of this new normal, there are parts of the population who share more specific and powerful experiences brought on by COVID-19, among them those who have actually been diagnosed with the coronavirus and recovered. This includes most people who have been affected with the virus, to be candid. An exact number is tough to pinpoint given the number of asymptomatic cases. But it's a group that includes some people you know, like Ray Benson. Guitar player, singer, and frontman for Asleep at the Wheel. Ray, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, Dave. Also, it's been good having you all on the air.
How you feeling?
I'm fine. I'm 100%. In fact, I'm better than I was before because during the illness, I was knocked out so in bed so much that I lost 20 pounds.
Good night. Good night, man. Well, I rang you up. I guess it was the weekend that we heard Kenny Rogers had died, and I was asking you a few questions about Kenny, and I didn't realize at the time, but you said you were not feeling good and that you had, you know, you wondered about whether or not you might have coronavirus. And then lo and behold, back on March 31st, you come out and publicly shared that, yeah, you were diagnosed. So you had it back when we were chatting, I guess.
Yeah, evidently. It appeared what happened was we did that thing for Willie in Lubbock, Texas on the 17th. I was feeling kind of bad, but I just figured whatever, you know, and then I felt real bad. And on the 18th, it hit me like a ton of bricks. And I went to bed for 2 days. Then I went on the 21st to get a test. I didn't have any respiratory problems and I didn't have any fever. And they wouldn't give me a test because I did not have those symptoms. So I went back home and I figured, oh, whatever. And I'm still feeling bad. 3 days later, I go, this is bad. I got to go in. And mm-hmm. here's what it is. You get nausea, dizziness, fatigue, couldn't eat. But that was it. So none of the ones that everybody assumed was the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. So finally on the 25th, I go in and my doctor said, I said, I don't know, give me a blood test. It's anemia or something, you know? And they did all that. And then she said, I've got a COVID test. I went, really? Oh, and they gave it to me. 24 hours later, they called and said, you got it. If you have any respiratory problems, get to the hospital.
Wow.
I didn't. They just, you know, hunkered down and the symptoms went away in about a week after that. So about two and a half weeks of that. I went public because I couldn't get a test. Otherwise, I would not have gone public. But the outpouring of love and concern was incredible. I mean, it was really heartwarming to have all of that. The lingering effect was my back went out because of laying in bed for, you know.
Oh, my gosh. You're kidding. Wow. Yeah.
So that's good now. I spent a week stretching and doing all that, and it's getting better. And because my friend Christopher Cross, he says he can't walk because you just lay there and your whole body just atrophies kind of.
Well, given all these unknowns, how do you move forward as a musician, Ray? I mean, are you going to get back? Have you thought about, okay, well, I'm going to, by some date, I'm going to get back in that bus and hit the road? Or how are you thinking about
it? I don't know, Dave. You know, the answer is I don't know. You know, we go places and shake hands. And I was talking to Lyle Lovett. Lyle's worried that we're not going to, that nobody will even book acts until 2021. And even then, they don't know whether people will congregate. I wonder if crowds are going to be allowed or willing to congregate, you know. So we're all in the same, you know, we're not in the same boat. We're all in the same quandary as to what are we going to do. You know, they talk about the vaccine. I offered myself up and have heard back. I said, hey, happy to be a guinea pig because, you know, I survived it and I think I'd survive it again if I got it. Not that I want to, but we got to find out. Internally, yeah, I've really been sitting here, you know, every day going, you know, there are times that delineate aspects of your life, et cetera. This is one of them. 9/11 was one of them. You know, the world's going to change. I know it's going to change. And this is one of them. I think people have been incredibly supportive of the music and the arts communities in terms of online and this, that, and the other. But, you know, I've always said that there's a premium on going to see people in person because we're humans and there's something that goes on between humans face to face that is not going to happen on video. Hopefully, we will all get through this and hopefully we will be back on stage. But I don't see anything in the near future.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you ever get the chance to see Ray Benson in Asleep at the Wheel live, you got to do that. And we all look forward to your return to the stage or, of course, online, too. Ray Benson's frontman for Asleep at the Wheel, and he has recovered from COVID-19.
Thank you, David. Y'all are the best. We love listening to the show.
Thanks, man.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The official footwear of Texas is the boot, but some Texans struggle to find the right boot, especially if they need a special size. Today's installment of From Heel to Toe, Stories About Texans and Their Boots, features Tex Randall, one of the tallest Texans, and of course, his boots.
Hello, my name is Buell Martin. I'm 87 years old. We live in Canyon, Texas. Sandy and I have been married 63 years. Her name is Sandy. And Canyon is a great little town. And of course, you're familiar with the Tex Randall statue. And he was put there in 1959. He's about 47 feet tall. And when he was made, Levi Strauss furnished him some Levi jeans. But you know, out here in West Texas, there's a lot of wind and there's a lot of pretty harsh winters. And finally, he couldn't keep clothes on him. And they finally just painted him. Whenever we started trying to raise money, well, Sandy, she was on the board of directors at the Chamber of Commerce. And we put a pair of Wrangler jeans on him, just with paint. And he was standing there with his big old boot. And at that time, it was a Justin boot. And then I told him, I said, well, if you really want to get some money, we got a real big Coors beer distributor. We could just put a Coors beer can in his hand. And they said, oh, no, no, we can't do that. Canyon is dry county. Well, we finished him up in 1989, and then I think it's like 2012 or something like that, we started back. And West Texas A&M, we got the university to give us some money, and well, we would put the WT on the boots. And my niece is an artist, and the people that were helping redo the Tex Randall said, do you think she would paint Tex Randall?
I was 67 when I painted Tex Randall. I am Rhonda Simmons. It was an adventure. The first time I figured out that I was going up in a bucket, you know, like electricians called a cherry picker, I think. I was introduced to my driver, and he was a young Spanish man. And I didn't know till we got to the top that he didn't speak good English. Didn't understand what I was saying. And then I found out he was the one that actually did the repairs on the face. He sculpted the nose and the eyes. They wanted them to be authentic to the way the boots look that they designed for WP. I have to say that Tex Randall was such a great opportunity. God just blessed me so much doing that. I'm disappointed now that it started to fade, but maybe it won't get much worse. This is Rhonda Timmons, and I appreciate you and your interest.
Okay, everybody. This is old Buell Martin here in Canyon, Texas. You're listening to the Texas Standard. I ain't saying, I'm just saying.
Got a story we should feature on From Heel to Toe? Email us, texasstandard@kut.org. By now, it's been at least a month of learning at home for most Texas students. Some have been at it even longer. How's that going? KERA's Bill Zeeble was wondering that very question, and so he stopped by a Dallas area high school's virtual classroom to find out.
Hello.
Look at you.
Is that Donnie? Great.
Nearly two dozen 11th graders log into Mark Harrington's AP history class every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. They mostly have the routine down.
Johnny, why are you taking up the whole screen?
I do not know.
Harrington knows his students are familiar with online learning because he's used it for years. What's new, though, to them and the rest of the world, is how things like Zoom meetings have replaced almost all of that in-person interaction. Harrington didn't want his students to completely lose that classroom feel.
This is the only time we get to video call our teachers, so this is the only time we can actually get our questions answered. If you were in class, like if you had questions, you could ask the teacher after class, you know, like after the class is over.
Yeah, this is the only class we have a video chat for.
That was Johnny Trevino and Demetria James, who see benefits of meeting like this with everyone together. That said, most of these Segoville students told me they also like remote learning at their own pace. Take Victor Guzman.
I really like online better than school because, like, you do the work whenever you want. Like, yeah, whatever time you want. And, like, in school, you got to be there early. Yeah, and I really be waking up, like, late.
Though Guzman's been waking up in time for Mark Harrington's AP History at 10. Students access it through the education app Edmodo. Kids say most of their other teachers use Google Classroom. The apps are similar and allow students to click on assignments, complete, then turn them in securely. Segoville student Nyjah Rhodes worries overall that learning long distance may compromise her education.
At times, it's more like I'm just looking up stuff and I'm not soaking what I'm doing in. I'm just looking up stuff to do work or turn an assignment in. In school, we can't really be on our phone, so we really have to actually take in and learn.
Personal preferences aside, learning does happen online, according to Southern Methodist University's Jennifer Culver. She's the Technology Services Director at the SMU Education School.
There are a lot of ways for students to take in content and a lot of ways for students to represent and provide evidence of learning that wouldn't require constant on-time, real-time interactions with the teachers.
But this shutdown and shift to home all happens so fast, finding the best way to learn long distance is still a work in progress. That's according to Peggy Simmingson. The UT Arlington Associate Professor has been teaching online for a dozen years.
A lot of people had to hit the ground running, and so they were, you know, building the airplane as you're flying it, so to speak. And so I think with the summer and maybe the fall, depending on where we're heading, people are going to be able to feel more confident with their online teaching and try new things and, you know, even be innovative.
Innovative or not, many students' lives are not conducive to learning from home. Edward Zapata says this has not been easy.
It's painful because I have two nephews. Sometimes I have to watch them, but I also have homework.
Others have no home at all, like Nyjah Rhodes learned the other day.
We saw one of one of the students that go to our school, and he's homeless, so he usually depend on school for food and a place to be at. And we gave him our food and money, but it changed my perspective for people who actually need to be at school because they don't have nowhere else to be.
Teacher Mark Harrington says district officials know about the student and have reached out to his family. No matter their situation, Miranda Serrano sums up her Segoville classmates' take on this emergency education.
Yeah, I like this class because it is AP. It's like, I like the challenge, but I don't like the challenge of having halfway through the year going through a pandemic.
Neither does instructor Harrington, but it's giving him a whole new outlook on teaching history. I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Have you received your share of the $2 trillion stimulus package? If not, do you happen to be married to an immigrant who doesn't have a Social Security number? This week, a federal class action lawsuit was filed on behalf of six U.S. citizens in such situations. They claim they are being unconstitutionally denied economic stimulus payments because of the person they're married to, or to be more precise, because their spouse doesn't have a Social Security number. Joining us now is Diane Solis. She covers immigration and the border for the Dallas Morning News. Diane, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
One of the plaintiffs in this lawsuit is a woman that you had previously reported on and spoken with, Christina Segundo. What's her story?
Christina is a Fort Worth mom of four who's married to an immigrant from Mexico, and she really needs the stimulus checks. Under normal times, she'd get, more than $4,000, I think, for her, her husband, and for the four U.S. citizen children. But because she's married to an immigrant without a Social Security number, she is ineligible. They were excluded from the CARES Act.
Just to be clear, does it matter what your immigration status is, or does it matter that your spouse isn't using a Social Security number to file taxes?
It matters that your spouse isn't using a Social Security number. But that generally means you're unauthorized, generally because some people who are getting legal permanent residency still haven't gotten their Social Security number. It's a long process. So they could be in process. They could be here lawfully or trying to get that legal status and are not deportable, but they don't have the SSN yet.
I just want to understand something. Is this something that Congress built into the CARES Act, that is to say, you're only eligible if both taxpayers, in this case, the husband and the wife, have a Social Security number? Or is this an administrative rule that's just being arbitrarily applied to filter out suspected undocumented immigrants?
It's in the CARES Act.
So it's actually in the law.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that the plaintiffs are arguing here? How are they making their case that this is unconstitutional?
They're using an argument of the Fifth and the First Amendment that it's unconstitutional because it doesn't provide them due process. Pretty understandable under the Fifth Amendment. The First Amendment argument is more creative, and they're saying that it violates their freedom of expression and association. Freedom of association, and since they chose to fall in love or marry who they married, and they express that union by filing jointly with SSN and what's called an I-10, an individual taxpayer identification number. These have been used for years, mm-hmm. So much so that there's even studies on how much I-10 filers pay into the system. A 2014 study said $9 billion in annual payroll taxes are paid through I-10 numbers.
Any idea how many families may be excluded from these payments because of a mixed immigration status?
MALDEF says in their suit that nearly 2 million families have adults in
just
this
to be clear,
situation.
MALDEF is the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund. Is that right? They brought the suit?
That is correct. Yes.
Now, what are federal officials saying about this lawsuit? Has there been any formal response?
There's been no formal response yet. It was filed Tuesday night.
What about possible legislative fixes here? Could this just disappear if there were a tweak to the law?
Indeed, it could. And the tweak is called the No Taxpayer Left Behind Act. And that is has been proposed, and it's people are somewhat doubtful that it will get traction. But one never knows.
Well, this is a developing story that Diane Solis continues to follow. She is immigration and border reporter for the Dallas Morning News. We'll link to her latest on this story at texasstandard.org. Diane, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Monitoring what Texans are talking about on this Thursday, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. How are you doing?
All right. How about you?
Holding up there. Doing okay. And we're hearing from lots of folks there about the stories out there today. I mentioned this one earlier, Thursday being the day that new unemployment data is released. Mm-hmm. And that another 3.8 million Americans filing for unemployment last week, 254,000 Texans filing last week. On our Facebook page, continuing to hear stories from folks about how this has personally affected them and their families. Leah Keese says that her son applied last month in the middle of the month, the 16th. He just got his unemployment insurance last week. I applied on 4/15 on April 15th and nothing so far. She goes on to say that I think the system is patently absurd, waiting weeks for this when someone doesn't have a paycheck. No wonder there are miles-long lines at food banks. For a state that has $1 billion rainy day fund, we sure can't take care of our people very well. And as we were discussing earlier, David, with the governor's order going into effect permitting businesses to reopen on this Friday, tomorrow, it's going to be interesting to see what that will do, how many people will indeed have to go back to work, because of course this is voluntary on the part of the business owner, right. But still, that is definitely going to change the calculus when it comes to unemployment insurance in Texas and in other states that do have the reopening on the books.
We're hearing some anecdotal stuff from mm-hmm. some business owners who say that some of their workers are saying they're not going to go back for various reasons, sometimes because they're afraid of conditions out there. Mm-hmm. In other situations, they're saying they're actually getting more money on unemployment than they would if they returned to work under part-time conditions and such. So it's interesting what all is playing out there.
There's that. There's also the conundrum of child care with you know, schools being closed, many daycares being closed. So obviously, yeah, just kind of a mess out there for many Texans. Well, another story that has folks talking, mentioned this one earlier as well, Texas Tribune reporting that Texas A&M, Texas Tech say they plan on resuming classes in the fall, football
just
included. Yeah, UT Austin planning to reopen as well. I guess they've been a little more circumspect, I suppose you could say, in the announcing their plans, not really coming out as A&M did. Chancellor John Sharp there saying he's eager for football to start back up in the fall. Curious question here that we posed to our friends and listeners, whether or not this announcement is too soon. One perspective we have there from Brad Emmons, longtime listener. He says, none of it is too soon if we protect the most vulnerable now. So again, another question that it's interesting to see the sort of markers being laid down here, David, and whether or not that those will, you know, bear out as the virus progresses, as Texas reopens, as businesses come online. So, you know, we're just going to have to see how this one plays out, I suppose, like so much with this virus.
Yes. Like so much. You know, we're going to be looking back and seeing all kinds of interesting trends. I just see one in the Austin American Statesman right now. Coronavirus in the Texas capital city, stay-at-home orders and the cancellation of South by Southwest have sent overall crime rates plummeting, according to the latest Austin Police Department data. That's over at statesman.com. We're out of time for the big broadcast. We're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.